This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of LGIM Talks. My name is Robert St. George. In 1964, United States Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart wrote, "I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it." You may know what the judge was actually referring to when he wrote those famous words, "I know it when I see it," but they could apply just as well to the notion of investing in quality companies. For many years, what made a company or stock high quality was fairly subjective, but investors would always insist that they knew it when they saw it. Today, thanks to the wealth of data and computing power at our disposal, we can look more systematically both at what fundamental characteristics quality companies have in common and at whether those characteristics tend to be rewarded in the market. To discuss this topic of quality in more detail, I am joined by two very special guests. Fadi Zaher, Head of Index Research and Development at LGIM, and Anand Venkatramanan, Head of ETF Investment Strategies at LGIM. Fadi, Anand, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, nice to be here today.
Excellent. Now, Fadi, if I can start by turning to you. Quality can be thought of as a factor or risk premium in equities. You have literally written the book on this subject, Index Fund Management, A Practical Guide to Smart Beta, Factor Investing, and Risk Premia. So, for anyone unfamiliar with those terms, what are smart beta, factor investing, and risk premia?
Factor investing, it's one way to think about it, style investing. It's another way of thinking about it. And typically, we think about five style investing or five factors. And this is these are value, where you look at company in relation to its peers, how cheap or how expensive it is to its peer, or in action in relation to its the value of its underlying assets. Then you look at quality, which is obviously a focus here today, which is very much focusing on companies with sustainable businesses, profitable businesses over time. Then you have the other factor, which is the momentum factor, which is effectively the trend is your friend. You follow the popular stocks. And then they have the low risk, which is the low risk factor, which is typically stocks that are less risky, say, than the broader market or in relation to a basket of stocks. And then you have the size factor, which is the last factor here, which focuses on a small to mid-capitalized companies, typically companies less than, say, 15, 20 billion and below. So you capture these mid-sized companies and smaller companies. So this is really like the style factors. But one way to, I always explain it, I did explain that actually in the book, that I'm not trying to promote the book whatsoever, it's just basically an example that I've used there, where I think about factors, think about the portfolio as a meal. You know, if you like the meal that you eat, the composition of the portfolio is a basket of stocks. So that's the same thing as the ingredients into the meal. The factors are, in this case, like the nutrients like carbs, fibers, vitamins, or proteins. These are equivalent to factors are equivalent to the nutrients here. So people can obtain, say, for example, quality characteristics in portfolios in the same way as they can actually get different nutrients from different food, different ingredients. In fact, broccoli, you can get some protein, or spaghetti, you can get a lot of carbs. So this kind of one way to think about factor in a more simple way without going into too much details, but effectively you expect them to be rewarding you over time for different reasons. Some of them are reward for taking risks in the market. Some of them are driven by behavior of the market. And some of them are just simply how markets are organized. So that's really, it's just a crash course for you, Robin, on smart beta.
Great, thank you very much. And just to continue your comparison, based on your research, what kind of recipes can we use the quality factor in? How can investors go about defining it in meaningful, systematic, and consistent ways, so that they can access those nutrients that you mentioned?
Yeah, so I think about quality investing. I call it the darling of factor investing, and the reason why I say that is because actually, it's one type of like style that effectively aims to at least to reduce the so-called permanent loss of capital. You tend to invest in traditional businesses that are actually expected to remain in business for the foreseeable future. And in fact, this is actually not new, but we're going to go into that quality investing. But this is not new, really. It's the only thing is that it's new from a kind of the last decade, two decades, it started to be implemented in a rules-based systematic index strategies, like ETF as an example. But it actually goes back to 1930s to Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing, where he used to combine value and quality. So, I mean, when you think about quality, these are really traditional businesses, sustainable business models. They could be also newcomers as well, like smaller companies that are up and coming, and they actually start with good quality characteristics. It is possible to do so. And these type of companies are able to weather different market conditions and different economic conditions. So if you have a rising inflation, this company tends to actually maintain pricing power. And if inflation goes down, they tend to also maintain some pricing power. So these are really traditional. You can call them also, although I call them the darling of factor investing, they can also be actually boring companies that do soap, but they effectively, people still buy soaps and people still buy pharmaceuticals, medicines, people still travel in lifts, you know. So these are really consistent and traditional businesses in the world. And one of the thing is that when you structure a strategy in quality, there are two attributes to it. So first one is the qualitative attribute, there is some quantitative element in it, but that's corporate governance really. So well-governed company, typically these quality companies are well-governed companies. And that's very important part of the design. You can implement it as an overlay, which we probably could talk about later. But then you have the quantitative screens, and I call them screens, where you focus on profitability. Profitability is common to almost every single quality strategy out there in the world. Profitability is key. When I say profitability is the company's ability to generate profit to its shareholders and also grow the company's assets. And then you have also the quality, for example, of earnings, how good quality is of that earning of these companies. We look at something called accrual. And that is a way to say, like, we look at companies, how they're recording their revenues. Yeah, and how they record their revenues. Today, for example, if you take Tesco, would Tesco say, because they put, say, a product on the shelf, does it mean that they have actually booked a sale for that particular product? So we look at this type of things. And then you have, obviously, how the company is growing its asset. Is it growing organically or is it growing by large bets? And typically when you construct this, you construct a composite score of this. And that's what makes that kind of defensive mechanism in the quality factors. So that's really in sum. So the idea is that it's traditional businesses, profitability sits at the heart of this. You try to also maybe also understand companies' exposure to leverage. And sometimes leverage is not bad as long as it is, you know, healthy. But so there are different ways of looking at it.
Yes, excellent. Thank you for that, Fadi. And now, Anand, if I could turn to you. Fadi has set out lots of ways to think about quality quantitatively and qualitatively. How do you go about combining those into an investable portfolio? Are there any filters or definitions that are more helpful or more useful to you as an investor building a strategy?
I think there's no one-size-fits-all approach over there, Rob. I think it depends on what we want to do. You know, Fadi did kind of touch upon a few interesting points there as to how people have combined value with quality or growth with quality and things like that. So it's a question of what we want to achieve and, you know, and how we want to implement that, right? So clearly when it comes to, you know, imposing a quality screen, you could just have an overlay where you have some exclusions. And remove poor quality companies. That's like a very, very simple approach. Or it could be based on, you know, very specific metrics, you know, some of which Fadi have already mentioned, right, from earnings to profitability to, you know, accruals, leverage, asset growth, and so on and so forth. So you could you know, look at a variety of such metrics and infer as to how good a company is. But if you were to take a step back, you know, rather than sort of looking at the financial aspects of the metrics of a company, sometimes just the clear market positioning or the industry where they are or their business models themselves could actually provide them with the tailwinds that could make them better quality companies. And Fadi raised a good point there, right? So he mentioned about Tesco. So if you go back a year, sometime around April or May last year, or maybe give it a couple of months just after the market crash, when you look at the recovery phase and look at three specific stocks, one is Tesco, one is Marks and Spencer's, and the other one is Ocado. All three of them, UK retail giants with very different business models. Ocado, as you all know, it's an online only sort of a model. Tesco has some online presence, but also it's got these massive brick and mortar shops and our street corner ones as well. Marks and Spencer's, of course, it has a different business model, no groceries, but more clothing and so on. So when you look at those, although they were within the whole, within the same consumer vertical and retail vertical, there was a clear divergence between the way these stocks performed. Ocado rallied, Tesco's flat, Marks and Spencer's went down. So, when you look at a single sector or an industry itself, you could have huge divergences between different companies based on, what they're doing and their business models, what kind of tailwinds they have, what the consumer preferences are, and so on. So, there are clearly a variety of metrics that you can use to kind of measure quality. One could be, as I mentioned, the industry or the theme or the area they're focusing on. The other one could be the business models that they're adopting. And when you kind of look at it more from a systematic approach, then clearly the financial metrics would come into play. But overall, to kind of simplify things, clearly if you have tens or hundreds of different metrics, you can of course, over-optimize things and get it super right. But, the point is to sort of be aligned with a solid economic rationale and make sure there's a simple narrative that works consistently across different, regional exposures or different kind of sectors and so on. And that's kind of consistent across, as I mentioned, different regions and sectors, right? So, and when you look at it, the traditional approach would be, imposing a, exclusionary approach where you exclude the bottom percentile of stocks, or you kind of, have a composite score and end up tilting more towards higher quality stocks or kind of penalizing lower quality ones, right? So of course the approaches are varied. It also has to do with what type of weighting methodology we adopt. Is it equal weighting? Is it size weighted? And so on and so forth. And also what type of, primary factor that we want to gain exposure to. Is it value? Is it growth? Is it low vol? Is it size? And so on. So depending on that and depending on the ultimate investment objective, the different ways of measuring quality and different ways of applying. But the I would say the basic approach to sum it up would be an exclusionary approach. If not, you kind of add a quality-based tilt to your weights.
I see. Thank you for that. That was very helpful. But I guess many of the metrics you mentioned there are necessarily backwards looking at past performance, earnings, and balance sheet strength in the past. What does that mean for the resulting portfolios you construct with a quality filter? What kind of companies tend to end up in a portfolio based on those backwards looking quality filters? Fadi, if I could put that to you first.
Yeah, that's actually a very common question I have, Rob, when it comes to the way you do the screening, and it's an absolutely valid and a fantastic question. So if you start to unpack the drivers of the performance for any factors, we typically say there are three drivers, and then it comes to that question about backward looking. Number one is you can be rewarded for risks that you take. So take, for example, value. That's a very obvious one, or even momentum. They typically tend to be more risky if you measure it in a quantitative way than, say, the broader market. Broader market, I mean by S&P 500 or, say, a FTSE 100 type of benchmarks. They tend to be more risky, so you'll be rewarded for that risk. That's number one. Number two is really the behaviors, so market behaviors. So how investors behave and react to things. And I can give you an example that I think makes sense for quality investing. And then number three is the market structures, the way markets are organized. So if that's your starting point, you started to understand these different buckets. Now, we know that, for example, quality tend to be more defensive than the broader market. So you shouldn't really, as an anomaly, expect to be rewarded for that risk. You might just be rewarded for the market risk part that you're taking in, but you shouldn't really expect that to be the main driver for that so-called quality premium. Quality premium, I mean, is the excess return over the broader market. So take, for example, behavior. The reason why you see them being rewarded over time and the reason why you have the premium that has been consistent for decades is because quality stocks, as I said probably earlier, it's a different word, they are dull, they're boring. They don't have many exciting stories around them. Investors do not price that things in because they focus always on the hot stocks. Of course, we have seen lately, like Microsoft and Apple coming into the quality portfolios, but they are also obviously quite expensive. But then you have the traditional ones that has been there as far as I can remember, like companies like Unilever, Procter & Gamble, not to specify more company, but I'm just saying that these companies like consumer staples, these companies has been there and they are consistently there. So they are unlikely to change their business model. So, I mean, for example, Unilever is not unlikely to stop making soaps, or former AstraZeneca in this case, they're unlikely to stop doing medicine. You know, this is something that is an essential, that is important. They might have a bit of hiccups in their profitability for one quarter or maybe two quarters, but these companies are typically consistent. And you should look at it also from that. You should be expecting to also avoid these permanent losses. So that's from a behavioral, just giving a behavioral example. Actually, to be specific about it, we talk about something that is availability bias that people suffer from. People tend to judge things by how easy it comes to their mind. You know, if you're having a dinner with your friend and they mention a hot stock for you, and then when you want to make your investment, you remember that conversation and you go for that. So you ignore that potential of looking under the bonnets of what is actually inside this particular company. So that's an availability bias that I can attribute to this. The other thing is the market structure. Typically, you know, we talked about accrual, which is a way to the Tesco example where you put something on the shelf and you recognize it as a profit. I mean, you could say that this is a structure in relation to the way the accounting works. And so typically companies that tend to recognize their earnings much earlier than needed or before they actually make it become actual cash, they have actually underperformed over a longer period of time. This is both practically and academically something. So when you go back to this aspects of backward looking, it's actually, yes, the data are backward looking, but it doesn't change the fact that these are companies that are consistent and sustainable over time. Before, I know I've talked a lot about this, but this is fascinating because one of the conversations I've had with people over the years is that when you look at the tech bubble, like in early 2000, this was a valuation crisis. This was a cash flow crisis. There were small companies that were extremely overvalued. But then in this period, quality stocks performed because actually if you had focused on companies that actually deliver profits and are profitable and healthy cash flows, you would have actually been avoiding big sharp falls. Then you move on to another crisis in 2008. This was a financial crisis. This was a debt crisis, leverage crisis. You have companies that are highly leveraged, unhealthy leverage. You actually, those that invested in the highly leveraged companies suffered. So quality that captures some of that leverage elements have actually provide further protection. So this is like one way to think about it. So when you're using a diversified metrics, diversified ways of screening, different composite ones, you tend to capture this kind of traditional consistent businesses.
Thank you, Fadi, that was perfect. But I suppose you can conceptualize quality looking further ahead. I mean, I think Anand mentioned briefly earlier on the kind of quality we see in themes. And Anand, I know you look for these kind of thematic opportunities a lot. So what kind of quality process can you apply in your search for thematic growth? How can you kind of systematically filter for the quality opportunity in the future? And how do you go about doing that?
That's a great question, Rob. And it's quite, I would say, different to how people generally think about quality and you know, from a factor or a style perspective, right? If you look at thematic investing, I mean, these are areas that are in their early stages of growth. Some of them require a lot of capex. You know, you could call them money guzzlers because there is a lot of investment that's required to build your new assembly lines, to secure resources, and invest in, you know, human capital, R&D expenditure, and so on. But when you kind of purely go by, you know, how are their earnings looking today, then you could potentially end up losing those stocks, which could, you know, and give you that potential growth. So what we do within the thematic world, you know, depending on the themes, there's kind of a, you know, custom or a tailor-made a screening process. So themes in general are areas that that have the potential to grow at faster rates. And from our perspective, we would require themes to be growing as in double-digit rates before we kind of go away and build a fund on those. So clearly, you've got a, you know, very good tailwind there, either because they're bringing about efficiencies or they've got a, you know, increased adoption in terms of a faster growing consumer base and so on. So clearly, these are helping them, you know, increase their sales growth. And at the same time, that would end up translating into earnings, depending on how much of kind of, you know, investment they are plowing back into the firm itself, right? So so from a thematic standpoint, it is the industry in which a company is focused on or is focusing on as well, that would count, and how pure they are and how kind of closely they are tracking that particular theme or how interdependent these companies are with a particular theme. So that's number one. But then the second thing is, you know, if you take certain areas, so, you know, like healthcare and pharma and so on, these are, again, faster growing areas, depending on which aspect of healthcare, life sciences or pharmaceuticals you're focusing on. But that is quite different to a typical technology theme, right? So within the pharmaceutical space or the healthcare space, there's a lot of R&D expenditure. You know, there are sunken costs there to sort of develop and new drugs or diagnostic devices or treatment methodologies and processes and so on. But right after all that R&D expenditure, you've got another, you know, extended period of clinical trials. And then you have the approvals from FDA or EMA, which could go both ways, right? So there's a huge event risk there after all that capital that's been spent. You don't know if your drug is going to be approved or not. And even if it is approved, you don't know when another competitor is going to come out with a cheaper product, and how long will you have access to the market? You know, how long will you be able to dominate the market and so on and so forth. There are more uncertainties there. So in that case, the way we kind of impose a quality filter is by looking at, is their value growing? You know, is the portfolio of their, you know, focused, you know, orphan drug or kind of devices and things like that, is that growing or is their value depleting and things like that, right? So we look for those type of characteristics to try and weed out companies who are not necessarily plowing the capital into the right areas, right? So that is one way of looking at it. But then when you kind of move away from kind of themes, then, you know, you could kind of have a different filter altogether. But, you know, now going back to another company, right? I'm sure, you know, people are totally aware of how the stock price movements of Tesla and how it has reacted. Clearly, that's been in the press for quite some time. And of course, it was finally included in S&P 500 as well. But when you look at that stock, you know, it didn't have positive margins at all up until about 2 years ago. And you could attribute that partly to, of course, you know, they were starting off from a zero base, so they had to sort of sell cars slowly and ramp up their sales as well on one side, and at the same time make sure that the production volumes are catching up to sales. But more importantly, they had to invest in technology. The technology that they've used is very unique and very different to any other automobile company. And more importantly, they've also had to sort of build all these giga factories to manufacture batteries and so on. And these don't come you know, cheaply, right? So there's a lot of you know, capex that goes in. And as a result of that, you could clearly see that the margins weren't positive at all. But clearly now that has flipped, and we're hoping that could continue with the growth in the demand for electric vehicles and the demand for batteries as well, right? So clearly the tailwind from the theme is it's foremost how closely companies are engaged in the theme, how pure they are from a qualitative or a quantitative perspective. And thirdly, in terms of, depending on the themes, you might need to sort of look at having different overlays or screens to make sure you're able to weed out those less or poor quality companies.
Just one thing, Anand, I think it's quite interesting. You touched on the CapEx side of things. There is actually a very interesting behavioral study that I think I even discussed in my research, where you show that overconfident CEOs typically coming into a position or a company that has very, very overconfident CEOs tend to actually underperform over a longer period of time, simply because they take these big bets on the M&A, merger and acquisitions, instead of actually putting the money back into the business and doing the CapEx or the capital expenditure to replenish the business, to revitalize the business and grow the assets slowly. So this is actually one of the screens that I know we capture typically is the asset type of asset growth. So you look at how aggressively a company is growing its asset base. And that's just something that I thought was quite interesting, which is effectively touches on what you were saying.
Absolutely, Fadi. That's a great point. But I guess also more broadly, when you do apply these different kinds of quality screens, each one will shape the resulting portfolio in a different way. So what kind of correlations do you tend to see between a quality index and other kind of factor indices? Do you see quality biasing a portfolio towards or away from other types of factor or style or risk premia?
I typically say the correlation is a dynamic concept, and it's a quantitative, very quantitative concept. And I would say it's a bit dangerous sometimes to judge things based on correlation. But if you use this as a measure, if you look very historically, and it's one of the studies we looked at, we went back, I think, 40 years, and we looked at the correlation between quality and value as an example. And this is the holy grail of investing. If you find a quality company that is good value, there you go. That's kind of what Warren Buffett type of style, Benjamin Graham type of style investing. But when you looked at such a long history, we found that actually the correlation is extremely low between quality, for example, and value. In fact, actually, in some cases, it was negative, especially when markets are really tanking during very volatile periods. The quality tends to go its own way because it has that stability, while you have value really going down. So they go in opposite directions. So you have that negative correlation. But and because you've had few market corrections, or actually quite few of that history and some crisis, the correlation is even negative. So that to a point where it's actually a good diversifier. Now, lately, what is very interesting is that with the COVID-19 and all of that, we have seen Microsoft and Apple becoming a part of, central part of the quality strategies, where typically they have been actually growth. Growth is not necessarily a factor, but these have been typically growth, considered as growth stocks. So we're starting to see that overlap with growth, actually, with quality and growth. But the traditional companies are still there, like Unilever and Procter & Gamble, but they just trade at a lower multiple. So, and then you have the momentum. So, and this obviously have been momentum. These have been rising stocks. So you have seen a high correlation between quality and momentum lately, obviously. And you can find it in some period of time. But so that's like correlation is a very, very, I would say, it's a vague way of looking at it in my mind. But the idea here is that, yes, there is some correlation more to some factors, but there is less correlation to other factors. Mostly evaluate negative or close to zero, at least for a long history.
Yes, great. Thank you, Fadi. So from what you say, it sounds like quality can be conceptualized as something of a defensive factor, which does make some intuitive sense that these kind of companies would fare better in a downturn. So with that in mind, do you think quality can be used to complement other factors or perhaps to enhance them by adding some kind of defensive nature to those other factors?
That goes back to the argument that it's the darling of factor investing, because it's actually the one that looks at the company's financials. Obviously, they can be noisy, but if you smooth out that noise over a period of time, the idea is that if you complement it with value, even if it's just negatively or very low correlated, you might find in a screen that looks, say, of 2,000, 3,000 stocks, you might find good quality companies with some value. You might find that it's nothing possible if you keep doing it repeatedly, these screens. And it's definitely a compliment, because the genre or the classification within the factor space of what is defensive, you typically have that low risk factor, and then you have the quality factor. The quality factor depends on the financial statement, uses the financial statements and other qualitative attributes like corporate governance and et cetera. But then you have the low volatility that actually looks at the return, volatility of the returns, the fluctuation of the returns, which is more a market-driven type of measurement. So having like fundamental, really the underlying features of the company's financial statement embedded there should be able to give you another type of dimension, another way of looking at factors. So I would say it's the defensive, and it's supposed to be a defense to the kind of that momentum, and it could be working with value in a combined way. And I know Anand might have also some thoughts around that, because we have discussed this quite extensively in our research meeting over the years. So.
Yeah, you're totally, Fadi, and totally echo your comments there, right? And also when it comes to your question there, Rob, in terms of should quality always be viewed, or is it a defensive factor? I would say, you know, when you just look at, when you define quality as something that quality companies are someone who has, you know, better earnings, more cash, profitability, better, you know, balance sheet characteristics and so on, you know, these could potentially be, you know, characteristics of a growth stock as well. So it doesn't necessarily have to be countercyclical defensive stocks, right? You could find good quality stocks that are growing. So these could be, you know, companies who are, you know, have a growing business model and large capex. You know, the point that both Fadi and myself, we discussed just a few moments ago. Or it could be companies like the traditional ones that Fadi mentioned, like Procter & Gamble and so on, you know, traditional business models. And then you've got ample cash flows, you know, you've got stable dividend yields and so on, right? So it's a question of either seeing quality as a core defensive metric, or using quality as a cushion to say, here is my core focus area, but I'm going to add a quality overlay just to sort of weed out my, you know, the poor quality or the poor ranking stocks, right? So, you know, moving away from, you know, the thematic type of exposure that we were just talking about, where, you know, you saw those were, you know, market areas that were growing. So you had strong tailwinds from the sector, from the industry itself, in addition to growing business models of individual companies, large capex profiles, and so on. So if you kind of come out of that and then talk in the world of, you know, style of factor investing that Fadi has already spoken about quite a lot, within that, you know, the different ways of doing it. And I'll probably touch upon a couple of other, areas that Fadi's not perhaps mentioned. One could be dividends, and one could be, let's say, small cap area, right? So the first, if you take dividends, you know, dividends themselves, you know, when you look at a variety of academic research, many of them point to the fact that today's dividends or the past track record are, you know, good pointers of the earning potential, the future earning potential of a company, you know, how strong the cash flows are, how much are they plowing back, is that company growing, or is it better off sort of just paying all that profits that they make as dividends and so on. So those are, it's kind of a good leading indicator potentially for future earnings, right? So if you were to build a dividend, you know, portfolio, you could use a variety of screens, but it's also important to make sure that you're not, you know, investing in a stock that's paying dividends by bleeding its capital. You know, it's easy to sort of, you know, dip into your cash and then just end up paying dividends without making any profits, right? That's a possibility. But that means you're overall, you know, you're not kind of working towards capital preservation. Your, you know, capital bleeds, but you're kind of getting income. So how do you now identify companies who wouldn't sort of bleed that capital, who would still kind of generate that cash to continue and sustain those dividend payments, right? So you could have your own set of metrics there. You could either look at dividend sustainability, how consistent the dividends have been, what is the dividend trend, and so on. But you could stop there, but still, you know, there is always a possibility that amongst, you know, that universe of stocks that you've kind of, you know, narrowed down to, that could still be poor quality companies because you haven't necessarily looked at, you know, the profitability, you know, from a quality lens. You haven't necessarily looked at leverage and so on. Then you could clearly add an overlay on over and above your dividend screens to ensure that you weed out those poor quality companies. So that's one example. The second could be, you know, if you have a, you know, typical small cap exposure, then in that case, you know, just adding a quality overlay on top of that. And I'm sure Fadi can kind of comment on this because he's devised some of those, target exposure strategies there. You could try and devise a strategy where just having your market cap exposure, but tilting the weights of the stocks in a manner that improves the overall quality profile of your basket could end up yielding some benefits. It just gives you that added buffer in case things go wrong, or, you know, generally when you're holding your portfolio for a long time, having exposure to, you know, more exposure to better quality companies should, you know, yield you that additional, you know, quality risk premium. But Fadi, I mean, feel free to add in here because I know you've worked a lot on this area as well. You've designed some of the targeted exposure type of approaches of how you can kind of blend value, quality, or, you know, design a multi-factor approach, you know, targeting a certain exposure. You know, would be keen to hear your thoughts.
I think you touched on, I think you summarized it very, very nicely. I mean, one thing with these quality companies specifically is that you want them to be able to support their distribution of dividend. That's the key, you know, the sustainability of that dividend to be there. And you want these companies, obviously these are profitable companies, consistent businesses, that doesn't just fall off the cliff very easily. Yeah. There is a parachute somewhere there that makes them do that softer landing at least. And especially the way you obviously build certain strategy, you have diversification embedded in it. You don't take a bet on 5 or 3, 6 or 7 stocks. You really have hundreds of them to some extent, you know, to diversify that element. So I think that links both to what you said, Anand, and also what question from Rob. It's really like quality is used as a complement to a lot of the other four factors. So I've had cases where investors wanted to have quality combined with low volatility, low risk, because one of them coming from the market side, which is kind of noisy, how the market is pricing in, you look at the returns, and then one is coming from the fundamentals of the company. You're combining that too. That's effectively diversifying the defensive nature of the stock market, then, as an example. And then you have others who wanted to basically combine that with value, or some others who basically says, we want to have quality, but then we want to have controls that we don't have too much exposure to, say, other factors. So it's really, I mean, I always say factor investing is not just a science, and there's an element of art. It's like investing. It's an element of art embedded into this. And I think that's what we're trying to some extent get to, because you can do it in so many different ways. And for me, and also I'm sure for Anand, for many discussions we have, the most important thing is to understand what is it that you're trying to really achieve. Yeah, the outcome, the objectives of the strategy, having a purpose. And then from there, work out the solutions, because there are different ways of coming to that solutions. Back to you, Rob.
Thank you very much. Now, finally, I suppose one alternative way to think about quality, and one we emphasize at LGIM, is in terms of responsibility and sustainability. Paddy, I know you mentioned earlier on, you can apply corporate governance screens quantitatively, but how broadly do you think ESG can be reflected in a quality approach?
Yeah, so I mean, our investment stewardship team has been doing a great job lately and historically. I say some of our work that we have been doing also for index strategies is something that we also tend to infuse directly. But there is a very important part, which is I think it's important to emphasize that I would see this as also a complement to the investment process, how you engage and the corporate governance element of especially for quality and initially for broader investing. But the engagement part, obviously, is a complement to the investment process. And what we're trying to do there is really to engage with companies to change behavior. So you have themes that you typically engage on. And one example would be shareholders' right. And shareholders' right, you can define it in different ways, you know. And then you have other elements where how the company, for example, CEO, chairman separations, and engaging on some of these topics to actually raise the market standard, because that's what you're trying to do as well, to change behavioral companies, raising the market standard, trying to reflect that. And effectively, that will come through the assets that you manage. You can do that also indirectly by doing the engagement, but you can also do it directly by actually designing a metric from a, say, environmental, in social or governance element, and you can infuse that to the index or the investment strategies. And that's another way we also have done so. So that kind of tends to really, really work very well. We know that this is one of the hottest topics and probably one of the biggest topics of the decade, the transition to a low carbon economy, better well-governed companies. And so, yeah, so we talk about that. And I know that, for example, in most of our strategies, we tend to now consider that. And I was just giving you some stats actually from the surveys that I think the FTSE survey, annual survey, I think over 50% of the asset owners and investors in the world today are actually looking into this type of elements, like corporate governance elements and sustainability and ESG in the investment strategies, whether it's active or an index. But that's just to give you an idea. Same survey, when you look, say, 5-6 years ago, we hardly talked about 30%, you know, just to give you an idea. So that's an important part for LGM, and it's an important part that we're seeing also happening in the world.
Great. Well, thank you both for a fascinating and wide-ranging discussion. As I said, it's been wide-ranging, but if you could summarize it in a single line, how would you summarize quality and what it can offer investors?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to keep it simple, understand what you really want for outcome from the strategy.
Totally, I would echo that as well, Fadi. You know, keep it simple. It has to be built on sound economic rationale, and the narrative has to be simple.
Excellent. Anand, Fadi, thank you very much. And I hope you've all enjoyed this episode of LGM Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only, and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgm.com.